lot of us who love drag love it because it channels the spirit of those wild, outrageous women who embrace their rebellious side and point their middle finger at what the world wants them to be.
Today, Peaches Christ, San Francisco's drag impresario and cult film fanatic, joins us to take a look at movies with wild women who don't give a fuck. Listen as we take a look at sexploitation and hagsploitation in films like All About Eve and Showgirls, Valley of the Dolls and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and Female Trouble and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Plus, what's it like to ride in the passenger seat with Faster Pussycat Kill Kills Tura Satana at the wheel?
Can anything be taboo anymore?
And everything you wanted to know about forced feminization, but were too horny to ask. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Hello?
Hello, is this Peaches Christ?
Yes, it is.
Yay!
Is it the pitted peach or the unpitted peach?
It's the peach after what's his name?
Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah,
you just
say, that's how I feel and look.
Crushed and oozing.
Crushed and yeah, filled with cum.
Now, did you know that scene was coming? Because I know I contacted you like when I saw it. Because like I didn't think about you during the scene, but as I was going to the car, I was thinking about that scene, and then I thought about you, and then I just started laughing. I was like, "Why are you laughing?" I'm like, "Because of Peaches." And I wrote something to you. I'm like, "I don't want to spoil it, but go see it." Did you know the peach was coming?
No, I did not. And I was like watching it and like loving it. And then afterwards, when I would bring it up to people, I could tell they weren't having. Except for you, I guess. Most people didn't connect that scene with me, unfortunately.
I'm surprised that people don't realize that when they're seeing a hot young man fucking something, they don't think of you immediately.
Hello. Especially when it's a, you know, a beautiful peach. So, yeah. But I mean, the whole time the scene was happening, I was like, oh, my God, everyone around the world is seeing this as an homage to me. But I found out pretty quickly. People were like, huh? What? I'm like, you know, the big peach scene in my honor. And they're like, oh, I hadn't really gone there.
Well, now that we've said it, now they'll all think about it every time that they fuck a peach. They'll think of you.
I hope so. I mean, I wonder if it's going to be a trend setter, you know, like if now teenagers will try it.
Yeah. I prefer a hot melon from the microwave myself.
Really?
Well, yeah, I need the size. It's like that peach would just, you know, would just blow apart.
Right. For me, it's usually like one of those enormous pumpkins, you know.
Pumpkin.
Do you put it in the microwave or you take it cold?
Well, it won't fit in the microwave, so I just like roast it over an open fire and then fuck it.
I'm just looking for a place to sit.
Yeah.
Have a cucumber.
How are you guys?
I'm doing good. You know, I don't know if you've been. Well, thank you so much for helping my GoFundMe.
You're welcome.
The stitches from the surgery are healing up nicely, and we're waiting to hear back of what's going on with the biopsy. And then in about, you know, but the doctor says that the prognosis is really good. And then in about 4 months, I will be able to officially declare cancer free.
That's awesome. And so when do you hear back?
Well, we're getting the stitches out on Monday. And so she'll it's kind of like, you know, being a contestant on American Idol. You know, they're like,
are you ready for your results?
Are you ready for the test results? And you're like, just tell me, you know,
right.
I think of the fact that I haven't heard from them now, I think means that everything's going good. Because before they were just like, we need to talk to you immediately. You know, they're like. And so doctors have like the worst poker face ever. If the doctor looks concerned, then it's not good news. If the doctor's like, eh, whatever.
Are you in much pain now?
No, it feels much, much better. It's like, it was definitely like fucking up my shoulder, and now it's not. Which is so weird, you know? Like, that's something like that would affect you so deeply, but it's like, I have this like fear. Like somebody who has been beaten up in an area, you know, you have this like psychological impact on that area.
It's crazy. I mean, when I read about what you were going through, it's like it hits close to home because so much of my family has had skin cancer. We were all raised at the beach, you know, and we didn't, you know, in the 70s and 80s, like, I don't think we really, maybe we wore sunscreen once, you know, I don't remember, but.
It wasn't a big issue. It was in the 70s, everybody wanted to get tan. We used to lay outside we would put butter or baby oil, you know, even Vaseline on our skin.
Bain de Soleil woman, you know, you want. In fact, I was told when I was a kid, hey, Fausto, the sun is free. Use it.
Because you were very white.
I was very pale, even for my own family, you know. So I'm like I'm the baby that was left underneath a rock and was exposed to sunlight. But obviously I was, because, you know.
You're like one of those, like, little grubs that you lift up the rock and they're all white underneath. Yeah. But they say that skin cancer, most of that stuff is damage, you know, as an adult that you got as a child, you know, or your teen years. So this is like, you know, this is cancer that's like 40 years in the making.
And to me, it's like, I'm not afraid or concerned about the surgery or the pain from, you know, if it gets to the point that I have to have radiation, I'm not scared of that. To me, it's the bills. It's the financial bills. Yeah. And so, you know, thankfully, we have the world's greatest audience, and you guys have really stepped up in helping us pay for the bills. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
What a nightmare country. I mean, it's just crazy.
I want to move to a place that has, like, actual universal health care and not this
farce. Think, too, if we have universal health care, which, too, is it would just show the nation that, you know, that we're a more caring country and that we care about its citizens. And so when we think about, you know, the society we live in and the violence that happens in here, maybe we could de-escalate some of that violence if we just showed we cared.
Are you saying that gun violence is tied to the fact that we don't give people health care?
It might be, because it feels like, you know, in this country, it's like everybody's on their own.
Every woman for themselves. And yeah, that's one of my attractions to the United States and to American culture, is that women sometimes are on the verge of a nervous breakdown. One of my favorite films by the Spanish John Waters, Pedro Almodovar.
Is that what he is?
He's, you know, when that film came out, there was many comparisons to John Waters, and everybody was like going, this is the next generation of John Waters. And Pedro Almodovar has said time and time again that John Waters has been a huge influence in his work. And, you know, just like you, Peaches, I mean, I would say a lot of what you do is influenced by two things, John Waters and the Coquettes in San Francisco. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like I have a lot of inspirations for sure, but I mean, definitely John Waters and the connection of me growing up in Maryland. And I mean, it's undeniably been such a huge influence. Certainly the Coquettes as well. And a lot of John Waters' influences ended up becoming things that I was, you know, fascinated by or obsessed with. And, you know, Pedro Almodovar.
Why do you think that, like, as gay men, we're connoisseurs of these wild women, these free spirits, these bohemian women who tell society to shove it up their asses?
Because it's about strength and kind of flying in the face of adversity, right? Like being your true self. I think we've talked about this before, I think, on the program, like, sexism and homophobia are completely interlinked. You know, homophobia is basically an extension of sexism. And so by watching and seeing women empower themselves and do and say and behave in a way that they're not supposed to is very inspiring to queer people, because, you know, we identify with that rebellion.
Is queer culture a feminist culture?
I think so. I mean, queer, you know, if you ask me, is queer culture a feminist culture? I would say yes, or it should be. If you ask me if gay culture was a feminist culture, I would say it should be.
It ought to be. Now, you recently saw the movie Love, Simon, or as you like to call it.
Love, Semen.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
Well, he certainly did. Okay.
And you were, would you, this is a gay movie, but would you say it's not really a queer movie? Or how would you categorize this film?
Well, it's definitely very effectively the gay teen genre film that is so mainstream in a way that's what makes it transgressive, if that makes sense. Hmm. Because it's so quote unquote normal, and it beats you over the head with that. I mean, there's a whole monologue in the beginning about how this kid is just like you and this and that. And it's like, okay, this would be fine if it were like 1984 and it were Molly Ringwald and the John Hughes movie, which is basically what it is. And that's what makes it sort of unique, is that it's so normal and it's sort of positioning of a gay story or a coming out story. But for me, watching it, the film centers around this white, very upper middle class, you know, kid who really has, you know, supportive parents, you know, a cool family, an adorable dog, you know, everything, you know, no worries about how to pay for college, no worries about religious persecution from your family members, like just none of the problems.
So where's the gay angst?
Yeah, exactly. All the angst comes from like a kid coming out of the closet or whatever. So I have to say, I mean, I know I'm probably going to piss off a lot of listeners, but I don't know. It was a bit eye roll inducing for me.
Underwhelming. It was a Molly, yeah. It was a John Hughes movie that was 30 years too late.
I feel like that in a way, and it lacked any sort of real edge. And in an era where movies like, you know, Tangerine or even Call Me by Your Name, I feel like was much more edgy or interesting because of the sort of taboo that it played with, you know, with this teenager having an affair with an adult, you know, an older man who played 24 but looked 40. I mean, they didn't shy away from making you feel the age gap, right?
Mm.
You know, for something like Love, Simon, it just feels kind of maybe too little too late to me. There's a character in the movie that's a black gay kid who wears beautiful longer hair that styled, and he wears, I mean, he's very genderqueer in the presentation, and, you know, he's the out kid at school, you know. And I said to my partner after we saw the movie, I was like, I'd much have preferred that the movie centered around that mm-hmm. character. You know, like that would have mm-hmm. been so much more satisfying for me. But whatever, you know, maybe we're getting to the point where not all gay movies are for all gay people.
Right. Well, it almost feels like, you know, when you have something like this, is there was such an edge to being gay at one point in time. And we've kind of in some ways lost that and become more heteronormative.
Have we been castrated by our desire to be loved and accepted?
Because
that's certainly, you know, like when I started putting together this list of these outrageous women in these films, one thing that strikes in mind is that half of them are like outlaws.
Yeah, I mean, being gay, I mean, being gay used to be kind of like cool in a way, because it was
illegal to be gay.
It was truly punk rock, right? Like it was really like, you know, it took a lot of courage and you know, to be out of the closet. So, I mean, those days, you know, I'm an old bitter queen now, you know, who sits around, you know, miserable about how easy young people have it. I'm totally teasing.
I mean, I would say
I'm not like that.
You're the least bitter person I know.
I'm not like that. But I will say that I miss the edge that gayness or queer culture had. You know, I do miss that sometimes. Mm. You know, but that's part of the price of acceptance.
You're such an anomaly or a one-of-kind drag artist, because I would consider you one of the top most commercially successful drag queens in the United States, that with the exception of All About Evil, you've not really had this kind of like mainstream career path that a lot of other drag queens have had.
Well, even All About Evil was not mainstream by any stretch. You know, it was niche. It's actually more popular in other countries than it was in North America, you know? So it's funny, because yeah, I'm about as niche as it gets. I'm a drag queen who's niche within the drag community, you know, but I always tell young people, you can still be successful. You know, I've made a very, you know, nice little living for myself, just staying the course and being true to what I, you know, enjoy or what I love, and, you know, working on the things that inspire me versus trying to, you know, follow a trend or become more popular. You know, I've actually become popular despite having, you know, no reason to, in a way.
Oh, come on.
People keep asking themselves, why is she a star?
Yeah, well, yeah,
she put the work in. I mean, how long have you been at it now? How many years in drag? Since 1993?
Oh, just a couple, two or three. I don't know.
Is it 25 years for you now? It is, isn't it? God.
No, it's not. I don't think. Let's see. I probably first did drag, literally, as far as wearing it from head to toe, in 1995.
Okay, so it's... Yeah.
So between the three of us, I'm the oldest drag queen here. I started in 1990.
Well, I did dress in drag in high school in 19 something.
But no, but I mean, where you performed and you said, I'm a drag queen in a drag show in front of other people. No. And they gave you dollars.
No.
Yeah.
And that was like, you know, I'm curious. I know we're getting off topic here.
It's okay. Nobody minds. Nobody cares. They're all like, they just want.
Hold on a second. So. When you first dressed up in drag consciously and you're like, I'm a drag queen in front of an audience getting the dollars, were you a little bit concerned or worried that like people might think that you're trans, or were you like, maybe I am trans? Like was questioning your gender identity part of the process of dressing up in drag for the first time?
No, it wasn't for me. I will say that I went through something along those lines, not so much wondering if I was transgender as far as identifying as a woman, but later in life I did look at, you know, what does this mean? You know, but when I was first doing drag back in 1995 at Penn State, you know, RuPaul had already come out with Supermodel in 1992. Drag was enjoying a sort of popularity with Wigstock and RuPaul and things. And club kid culture was very popular at the time. And my inspirations were Divine and, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show previous to that. So I didn't really see it as a trans identity when I started. I saw it for sure as a character and a performance, and really like thought about Peaches in the same way that I felt like maybe Paul Rubens thought about Pee Wee, or, you know, Cassandra thought about Elvira. So I really did think of it as a performance and kind of creating a character. And it wasn't until later that I realized so much of Peaches was about me unlocking something as Joshua, or something that was within myself, and that Peaches was really just this exaggerated form of myself, and that I had performed as Peaches for a decade at that point, and sort of started to wonder, like, well, what does that mean? And that's when I kind of got deeper into believing that a lot of drag queens who connect with it, and Coco Peru and I have talked about this, you know, as well, and I think Lady Bunny addresses this in her show Trans Jester, is that we're probably under some sort of trans umbrella of identity, and yet it's frustrating these days because we're often dismissed as cis gay men who don't know anything about a trans identity. And I think that's one of the reasons we've been talking about it so much lately, is because drag for us, especially for those people who've been doing it for decades, you know, in many ways, it could have been or might have been easier not to do drag after a certain amount of time. But that's some part of it's a reclamation of, you know, a gender identity that's not completely male, if that makes sense.
We started dressing up in drag before RuPaul hit the scene. And for us, it was definitely, we did it because it was outrageous. And it made us giggle in this very, like, you know, when you get this laughter with your friends that you're like doing something really wrong.
Naughty, naughty, naughty. Wearing women's panties.
And our inspiration was definitely John Waters, Kids in the Hall, and the performance art scene of the late 80s. when people were, you know, John Leguizamo, Linda Montano, Eleanor Anton, these cross-dressing performers who part of the idea is that you were taking you were creating this character that was not you, but a reflection of you. And then you passed it on to the public as if it was a real person. And so it was a crime, an art crime, for Paul Rubens to reveal that Pee Wee Herman wasn't a real person, or Elvira or RuPaul. And I remember very clearly the shock and outrage when RuPaul allowed herself to be photographed out of drag, and that photo of RuPaul with, you know, her chrome dome, her beautiful bald head, was shown in the gay press. And people were just like, how dare she, break the illusion. It was a wrong thing to do.
Well, back in the day too, it's like a drag queen, you would never know her real name. Like, it's even during this podcast in 2005, when we first started, like, you know, they just didn't want to be referred to as anything other than by their drag persona.
Misunderstood one time chewed me out on the phone.
Because you called her Alex.
Well, no, because we would ask, we would clarify, and even to listen to early podcasts with this, even Peaches Christ was introduced as Peaches Christ Joshua Grinnell. You know, it's like, we didn't feel comfortable in just identifying and reflecting to the person by their public persona. We had to always, and journalists, you know, this is a journalist thing. Like, journalists today, they go, you know, Vanessa Vangie Matteo. They don't talk about the person who creates Vanessa Vangie Matteo. They treat the drag persona as a real persona. And I think that's actually healthy and a good progress, that we're starting to accept people for what they tell us who they are.
And question their chosen name. You don't dead name them.
Well, and this is all tied to, like, you know, you're not a real man because you don't have sex with women. You're not a real woman because you are not assigned female at birth. And you're not a real artist because you don't follow the traditional path. You're not a real American because you don't vote for the Republican Party. You know, it's all this. It's all these things are tied to each other, right? And so, as kind of bohemians, as people, as artists, as people who are nonconformists, we have to fight our whole lives to be accepted for who we really are, and these creations that we make for ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of people do recreate themselves for all sorts of different reasons, but certainly, and we've talked about this before as well, certainly for a lot of men who do drag performance, it's a reclaiming of basically being gender variant as a child, or, you know, as a teenager, and being bullied for it and teased. And, you know, so drag is sort of the ultimate sort of, you know, basically, like we were talking about at the beginning, wild women sort of metaphorical middle finger to everyone, you know, regarding what's expected of them. And that's why I think in a lot of ways drag has such a powerful performance quality, is because it is the act of reclaiming something and owning it. It is like the literal act of owning something that, you know, was once used to hurt you. And so I think that pride in a performance just shines through. Even bad drag or sloppy drag or booger drag or whatever, I love it so much, because, you know, for anyone to do drag, it's a statement about fearlessness. If that makes sense.
As Sylvester sang, "Ooh, you make me feel mighty real."
Yeah,
and realness is always
to so many people.
It's such an important word in drag culture.
I was thinking about it. We were talking the other day, a friend of mine and I, about how interesting it is that drag con and drag culture is now so popular with young women and their mothers. And I said, it's that connective tissue. It's that thing, that big middle finger, you know, to what society expects of you. I think that more than anything, more than the femininity or the illusion or the beauty or the glamour, it's the fact that it's still, at the end of the day, transgressive, and it's basically breaking rules.
What do you think about movies? There's a couple of drag movies, Connie and Carla and Some Like It Hot. And those are both kind of like forced feminization movies. And what's interesting about both those movies is the characters have to get into drag because they're hiding from the outlaws. And they're both from Chicago. So in Some Like It Hot, you know, Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, they get on a train. They go down to Florida because they're like they witnessed the Valentine's Day Massacre in like 1929. They get into drag. His hilarity ensues. And then Connie and Carla also see like a mob hit here in Chicago. And they decide to go to the place where they won't be discovered, place because they're both like into the theater, so they want to go to some place where theater's not important, where there's no culture, so they move to LA.
And that's also the plot of Sister Act too, in some degree. Is
Sister Act is drag too, right?
Yeah.
Being it a is nun. Yes. Well, I mean, when I taught this class at SFAI, the San Francisco Art Institute, about the history of drag performance in cinema, actually the biggest example of drag movies is exactly that example, which I think is so hilarious and so ironic, because I've been living in a drag world for 20 something years and I don't know anybody who's ever been forced to do drag in order to get a job, save their life, save their family, you know, all this stuff. Like, I've never met anyone. I
know one drag queen who has dressed up in drag to save her family.
Who is that? Well, there you go.
Jade Sotomayor, her mother came on the show and said, Jade was working as a dancer, mm-hmm. professional dancer, but, and I was kind of like going, you mean to say that you guys couldn't pay the rent unless Jade dressed up in drag? And I was like,
they stood by it. Yeah,
they stood by that story. They felt like Jade dressing up in drag was instrumental to keeping the family mm-hmm. financially afloat at a time of crisis. And I was kind of skeptical about that.
But also, too, you kind of see drag, and especially now, you know, nowadays we have such a different perspective of drag because of the popularity of RuPaul's Drag Race. And, you know, a lot of these girls are making these huge incomes. But for the vast majority of your time in drag, you've known a lot of drag queens that are just like that have just scraped by.
And we're still scraping by, you know.
And they did it because of the love of drag.
We're not dumpster diving because it's edgy. We're dumpster diving because we can't afford to buy fabric or hair or hot glue guns or gemstones. But,
okay, so despite Jade, mm-hmm. you're really messing with my theory here. So could you not interrupt? Thank you. Okay. Despite Jade Sotomayor, my theory is that straight people, mainstream audiences, have always wanted to enjoy drag. Mm-hmm. The drag is inherently exciting to people and entertaining, but that these studios and the entertainment industry had to de-gay it as much as possible and take mm-hmm. any allusion to queerness out. And so, you know, they created scenarios where, you know, the men in Some Like It Hot were running from the mob, where Robin Williams and Mrs. Doubtfire was going to not be able to see his family, mm-hmm. where Dustin Hoffman was not going to be able to get a job if he didn't dress up as Tootsie. And there's a million examples of these, you know, from Fatty Arbuckle in the silent films all the way up to today. And that in my mind, I don't even want to look at them anymore. I just dismiss them because it's not that interesting. And really getting to the grit of when drag was presented in an honest way, mm-hmm. where the queerness was mm-hmm. intrinsic to the character's story. Mm-hmm. So my course, actually, we did like one little lecture on that kind of drag mm-hmm. and looked at a ton of examples of it. You know, including fabulous movies, Victor Victoria. I mean, these are good movies. Mm-hmm. I like Tootsie. I like Mrs. Doubtfire and Victor Victoria. Some Like It Hot. These are good movies, mm-hmm. but they're not honest, at least in a sense. They're kind of thieving in a way.
Yeah, in some ways. But also, too, when you look on YouTube and stuff, and we actually did a video called Forced Feminization, and it was our most popular video on YouTube for a number of years. It just Kim Chi's Cooking with Drag Queens episode just surpassed it. But there's something I think for straight guys, I think especially, like, forced feminization is an honest to goodness real fetish for them. It's like they get off on it.
Well, it's the perfect world, right? It's allowing you to do what you want to do that's naughty, mm-hmm. but you're off the hook because someone else got you to do it.
Yeah.
Well, so even that would be more interesting. Mm-hmm. That would be more interesting than what Hollywood, you know, put out. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not what this was either.
Mm-hmm. But I forgot the reason why Ed Wood Jr. and Glenn or Glenda, what was his argument for cross-dressing in that film?
Well, that actually is more honest to what Mark's describing. You know, he was a straight man who basically got off on wearing women's clothes. And in that movie, doesn't, you know, basically owns it as this strange, you know, he doesn't call it a fetish, but it's much more honest that he's just naturally drawn to wearing an Angora sweater versus, oh, I better wear this sweater because if I don't, you know, the mob is going to kill me.
I do like that. This Angora sweater or death? Which one?
But you know what I mean? Like, give me Angora or give me death.
That is really the Hollywood way, you know? I mean, Bugs Bunny, all of it, all that drag is really, it had been de-queered. And then we get to a point where, you know, John Waters comes along, the Rocky Horror Picture Show comes along. You know, things start to, I mean, that was really at the time, like Rocky Horror and the Rocky Horror Show, that was a shocking thing for people when that came out. Mm-hmm. That was really, you know, shocking. Divine was shocking for people because these were the kinds of people that lived underground. People knew they existed, but they were, you know, they were hidden away. They had their pageants and their balls behind closed doors, and they weren't allowed, you know, into mainstream society. I mean, La Cage aux Folles, of course, you know, France and other countries were kind of ahead of the curve as far as this stuff, but for American culture, these things were really taboo. And you know, maybe in the 70s with disco, maybe with the height of, you know, people like Sylvester, maybe if AIDS hadn't come along, we would have gotten, you know, there faster. But, you know, it really, in the 80s, the movies and stuff got extremely conservative.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely recommend people check out The Coquettes, the documentary, you know, because it really sort of showcases that unique change in mindset from sort of this pageant ballroom drag, like as seen in the documentary The Queen from 1968. Andy Warhol was a judge actually in that pageant.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and because one of the queens in that documentary, she was denied a crown.
Crystal LaVeja,
she laid the foundation for modern drag too in creating her own scene, which led to the New York ballroom scene as seen in the film Paris is Burning. And so we have two or three timelines, right? We have the John Waters timeline, we have the pageant queens timeline, and we have the ballroom scene timeline. And all those three of them kind of influenced drag and gay men in very different ways. And what I'm really interested in is how actual cisgendered women portrayed in film as these, you know, wild women, like Wild Women of Wongo is this old film that basically is this. Have you ever actually seen it, Peaches?
I have not.
It's, you know, you can.
It's one of the worst films ever made.
One of the worst films ever made. And it was this kind of morality tale, the idea that there's a lid for every pot. But the premise is that Mother Nature and Father Time have a bet to see, you know, whether men, about the nature of men and women. Mm-hmm. And it's this ridiculous premise that there's two islands, one has really hot women and really ugly men, brutish men, like cavemen. Mm-hmm. In bad prosthetics, and then you have this other island that has really hot men and frumpish women.
Ah.
And through some extraordinary circumstances, they discover each other, but they upset the crocodile god. And so the bloodlust of the crocodile god, which is a person in a prosthetic crocodile outfit, needs to be satiated. But ultimately, love saves the day, and the beautiful women and the beautiful men get to marry each other, and the ugly women, the ugly men get to marry each other.
And that's how Heclina was born.
Little do you know how true that is.
There's this great photo of Heclina eating an ice cream cone at McDonald's.
I shared it and it's gone viral.
What the fuck is that about?
Well, I just saw it. Like, it came up in my feed. Like, people were sharing different photos from the Reno trip that happened this past weekend. And I used to do that trip every year, and I was the den mother, and you know, I retired from it a few years ago, but this picture came up of Heclina and Pippi Lovestocking candidly sharing an ice cream sharing an ice cream cone together, like at McDonald's. It's just such a masterpiece. It just captures such a moment that is just, I don't know. I looked at it and I was like, is this where we're at? Like, they just look like something out of a movie. Just two old ladies just having a moment.
But like that stop at McDonald's for the, what is it, you guys call it, the mothership to Reno now? It's a trip, a drag queen bus from San Francisco to Reno. They put on a show and then the next day they go back. But they always stop at that McDonald's. And in fact, like the McDonald's now expects them, right?
Yeah, basically they know Easter weekend that bus is coming. So people kind of wait, and you know, sometimes there's people in the parking lot waiting. Of course, there's always people, you know, people eating at McDonald's who have no idea what's coming. Mm-hmm. So you know, there's still a healthy mix of surprise.
Someone needs to Photoshop the ice cream cones out of their hands and put cocks in there instead.
But I think that's why, I honestly feel like that's why the image is so great, because the cocks are literally what it would have been, you know, 20 years ago.
And, back when they could get
now,
cock.
You know, I think literally, like, if you asked Heclina and Pippi, you know, these days, like, would you rather, like, suck on this cock while you're sitting at McDonald's or have this ice cream cone? Like, they choose the cone.
I feel the same way.
That's where we're at. Yeah. Which I wasn't laughing at them. I'm telling you right now, like that picture is something I feel very much a part of.
It's super charming. There's a lot of charm to that photo.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I really love it. I mean, in a way, we've all kind of, you know, settled in and calmed down. But the fact of the matter is we're still in drag. And I love that.
You'd think that the drag would be the first thing to go, but it's always the last thing to leave.
You know, old men sometimes look like old ladies, and old ladies look like old men. So it's, you know, you can still keep doing drag as you get older. You could just be a little more feminine.
My mother says we're born androgynous and we die androgynous.
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, we basically are born. I don't think people are born with gender, you know, it's all taught to us.
Now, a common trope in a lot of these Wild Women films is the idea of the usurper, the woman that, you know, I think of a single white female or All About Eve or Showgirls or Valley of the Dolls. It's always about this successful woman who has a downfall because another younger, sexier, more beautiful, more charming woman is coming behind her down the stairs and pushes her down the stairs, literally in the film Showgirls.
Mm-hmm.
And all this can kind of be traced back to the films of Douglas Sirk, but, you know, like, I would say the first and the most important film is All About Eve, that won so many Oscars and, you know, it has so many huge stars in it, from Marilyn Monroe and, of course, Bette Davis as Margot Channing. And All About Eve gave rise to a musical called Applause in the 1970s that showed a portrayal of gay bars that was very bucolic and happy and enthusiastic, and with this wonderful song and dance number called But Alive, where Lauren Bacall croaks her way through this song, and it's just so charming.
She ends up in a gay bar in the West Village.
We're going to Greenwich Village. And they're like, Margot Channing, drat, I've been found out. 50 gay men dancing about how happy they are to be in a gay bar with their diva. And that's all the song is about. But ultimately, you know, the young ingenue usurps the big star, and all hell breaks loose, as Bette Davis says, buckle your seat belts, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Bumpy night.
Bumpy night?
Bumpy night, yeah.
Your first film was named in tribute to All About Eve. All About Eve. Mm-hmm. Why is that film important to you, Peaches?
All About Eve?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a lot of people look for the connection between All About Eve and All About Evil, and there actually isn't anything greater than the fact that
you just like the pun.
This filmmaker, she, you know, this is the character in my movie named all of her films with pun titles based on great works of literature. And so I was looking for a pun that worked for, you know, what the movie was about or what the tone was. But as far as, you know, the plot or the character, I would say the only thing about it that connects is sort of this desire for infamy or fame, you know, at any cost. And I think that sort of narrative in All About Eve was really delicious to gay men. I mean, we do like a good cat fight. We do like, you know, a wicked lady. And of course, All About Eve is the model that the great movie Showgirls is built on.
And you dedicated many Midnight Mass events, the shows of the Castro, to Showgirls.
How many? 20 years worth.
20 years, and you stopped. Now you're done with it. You purged it out of your system.
I wouldn't say that I'm done with it. I ended it as an annual event because after 20 annual years, which didn't just include the events in San Francisco, I also did Showgirls events in other places and I did other kinds of Showgirls events. So 20 annual years of celebrating Showgirls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
My favorite line from yours was like when she goes like, "You like doggy chow too?" And then you added this wonderful joke. You said, "Do you like it wet or dry?"
Yeah.
And there's so many lines that you wrote for the live show that I feel like you should license the script and allow, kind of like the way drag queens do Golden Girls, allow drag queens all over the country to do that show.
I like the line where you snort cocaine and Truvada.
Well, it's good for the muscles.
And it changed. The script for my Showgirls show was different pretty much every year. I'd revamp it, add new scenes, you know. We'd try to incorporate more of the movie than we had the year before. So, like, by the end, it had gotten ridiculous. And we also offered free lap dances with every large popcorn. So we had to bring out lap dancers and then do lap dances. And then we did, you know, a screening of a 2-hour-plus movie. So it was kind of an epic event by the time it was done. And I loved it, and I still love it, but I didn't need to do it every year. So all I've really retired is the idea that it's an annual event. And Ms. Berkeley knows she has an open invitation. And if she were to reach out to me and say she was ready, because I've reached out to her many, many times, and she wanted to do a screening with Peaches, of course I would mount an epic Showgirls event in her honor.
Because you're never too old for that hoary look.
Exactly. I'll put on that Showgirls bodysuit. You know, it's not like I've retired that. I just threw a big fucking chunky ass necklace on it and wrapped a sarong around my waist and became, you know, Isabella for our Drag Becomes Her show.
Oh, that's the same outfit.
Yeah, exactly.
What about films like Mildred Pierce, Sunset Boulevard, these kind of films with these, like, you know, has-beens or strong old women who, you know, especially Sunset Boulevard, you know, this idea that you're still a star. Yeah, I would say
Sunset Boulevard and Baby Jane are more in that category. Mildred Pierce is more of an epic tale of, you know, a woman's life, you know, whereas the Sunset Boulevard and Baby Jane are sort of those, they call them hagsploitation films. They did. That's what they called them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you see the movie Feud, it was kind of like, what the fuck do we do with these old actresses who can still draw a certain crowd? And, you know, they really saw these women. I mean, the sexism that's inherent to the making of these films is so disgusting and kind of extraordinary and interesting. And really, to me, it makes you admire the actors like Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and, you know, any of these women that later in life were given these roles who showed up and elevated these movies by their incredible performances. And But the things that they had to go through and the way they were treated and the way they were talked about is so disgusting.
Mm-hmm. I love that Bette Davis had a hit single from Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
And she even sang that on a couple of variety shows.
Oh, yeah. And it was like she could hit the perfect flat note, you know, and somehow like somehow make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, like her lack of singing ability still, you know, worked somehow.
It was marketed to be sort of danced to the same way Chubby Checker did the twist. So I don't know what style of music that is.
The twist.
You know, but you're supposed to dance the twist to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Mm-hmm. And in the record of it, she actually has the young actress who played the character in the film herself singing a duet with her. It's I don't know if you've ever heard the full song.
It's wretched.
It's really one of my favorite and most hilarious things, and you can watch it on YouTube. It's Bette Davis just is kind of like
she was not known for singing.
Where did my career go wrong?
Speaking of those kinds of later films that were sort of, you know, exploitative, in San Francisco, Matthew Martin, who's so brilliant, such a brilliant drag performer, who goes by his name, Matthew Martin. He is done both Joan Crawford and Bette Davis for years and years and years. In fact, is in a movie called Baby Jane, where Matthew plays Baby Jane. And you can find that movie, I think, online. But
I think we interviewed the director of that.
Yeah, he was on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Billy Clift.
Yeah, we had Billy, and they just kept ragging on Heclina the entire film. Because I think Heclina's in that movie.
She is, but you know what? I have to say, I mean, I'll be the first to rag on Heclina, but, you know.
She was great.
Heclina is hilarious in that movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, Heclina is a great actor. Like, she really is.
She played the next-door neighbor.
The concerned neighbor that gets killed.
She did.
Didn't she get killed in that movie?
No, but she plays the same role in my movie, Whatever Happened to Peaches Christ, which we had done years before, and I chainsaw her head off in that movie. So you might be
thinking of that. It's satisfying to see that happen.
Well, and then I serve the severed head to Martini, who's in the wheelchair, you know, instead of a rat. And, okay. One of my fondest memories, this is completely like side railing, but one of my fondest memories, I'm going to have to release this, is we had stuck Heclina like in a, you know, a table with a hole in it so that she was, you know, kneeling underneath the table and then her head was surrounded by, you know, lettuce and tomato garnishes, and we stuck an apple in her mouth and we painted her face to look like it had been barbecued with grill marks and everything. And then stuck like one of those giant domes that we made to go over her head. And then we brought Martini in, you know, to do the scene. And we said, okay, I said, action. And we'd never done a rehearsal. And so Martini, who's really kind of quiet and sort of plays an idiot, you know, all the time, even in all, you know, in her performances in the movies, Martini lifts the hood of this, you know, what do you call that thing? The hood for the dish.
The serving cover.
The serving cover. So she lifts that up, and I said to Martini, like, when you see the face, you know, this is your close-up, like, just scream as loud as you can. Well, Heclina hadn't heard me say that or whatever, so Heclina's waiting there with the apple, and she has her eyes closed. And Martini lifts the hood up and screams like we'd never heard her scream before, like at the top of her lungs. And that apple flew out of Heclina's mouth, you know, in total shock. Like she just spit it out of her mouth. It landed in Martini's lap. And it's one of my fondest blooper memories. So was Heclina actually being scared by Martini's scream.
So that didn't make it into the final cut?
No, but it should have. And I'm actually thinking about putting all those short films online soon, because they're really ancient drag history at this point. So
they're fantastic
bloopers on. But anyways, Heclina played the same character in both movies. Oh, I know what I was going to say is Matthew Martin is starring in a stage show version of Trog that's opening up this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Oh, David Serta and his theater company here in town did a drag version of Trog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And the chog was really hot. He was a ginger, and we used to run into him at the Whole Foods, but I think he was straight identified.
He's trying to identify as straight, but he didn't mind the attention from gay men.
Trog, no.
Trog, no. No, Trog.
Yeah, I bet.
That was her last film, right?
Yes. Wait, was Berserk after that, or was Trog?
I guess Trog was her last film. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. Poor Jones.
Yeah, so good. Did you guys watch Feud?
I didn't, know. Did you get to watch it?
Oh, it's so good. Oh, my God, I loved it. You really, really need to watch it.
Is it on anything yet? Because right now I don't have cable. Is it on any of the Amazon?
I don't know. I think it's on Amazon. I think we bought it because we just wanted to watch it. So we bought it on Amazon.
Olivia de Havilland is suing them.
I know, which is kind of strange if you watch it because, I mean, she's not, I don't know, like, Catherine Zeta, I don't know. I guess she feels like she was misrepresented, right. But you know, you don't watch it and go like, wow, they really trashed her. I mean, I think it's a really beautiful, you know, beautiful portrayal of all of them. It's very loving. I think it's one of the gayest things that's ever been on TV. It's just so, it's so good. Oh, my God. You guys have to watch it.
All right. I'll start watching it. Yeah. Well, Olivia de Havilland, you know, she's 102 now, I think, and she's living in Paris. And she said that the people had an opportunity to speak to her about her character, but they chose not to, and that they misrepresented her. They had her say, like they had her swearing, and she's just like, I would never say those things. But then they found a clip where she did swear. So they're like, well, we got you here. So I'm not really sure what's going to happen with that lawsuit.
Yeah.
Of all these films that have inspired, you know, drag queens the most, for me, like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is
definitely Saltina's inspiration.
Tura Santana, you know, for me, it's like that. She's so goddamn beautiful, you know, and
just pissed off and mad at everything.
Mad at everything. And, you know, that I could really relate to that feeling.
Yeah. I guess I'm allowed to talk about it, but I was interviewed for a documentary about Tura Santana that's going to be coming out. So I'm really hoping that lots of people get to see that movie and discover her and then go back and watch Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. But they've interviewed John Waters for it and Dita Von Teese. So it has, you know, it has the power to reach a new audience because of who's in the movie, you know.
And you actually knew Tura.
I did, yeah. We became really close over the years because my first ever Midnight Mass show was Faster Pussycat Kill Kill and a Tura Santana lookalike contest, and never did I dream that I'd meet any of these people ever. And then years later, after Mink Stoll had come and some other folks had come, I did reach out to Tura, and she did come and do Midnight Mass. And then we stayed in touch and stayed friends. And then we ended up doing more shows together in San Francisco, as well as I brought her to Seattle. And we did Comic-Con. We did a show in San Diego, and then we did a show in Los Angeles together. And I really got to know her and her family, and her manager became a really good friend of mine. So Tura is a great example of a woman who also used drag in a lot of ways. I feel like Varla, the character, not Varla Jean Merman, but the character in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, Varla, was a sort of archetype that she helped create with Russ Meyer, of a dangerous yet sexy, you know, shit kicker of a woman. And
a sadistic go-go dancer.
Yeah. And I think,
poster.
Yeah. And she was. And I think what Russ did was take parts of Tura, much like you would like a drag performer, and exaggerated them. They exaggerated them together, but Tura was a go-go dancer. Tura was on the burlesque circuit, and Tura was a fighter, and she did know martial arts before she ever. So the Varla character, in a lot of ways, was an exaggerated version of Tura. And so later in life, when she would do these shows with me, she would put on the Varla outfit, the black top, the cinched waist, the leather gloves, and the black wig with the bangs and everything, you know, that ended up becoming so imitated by women over the years, you know, that look of hers. It hadn't been done before, you know. So she would put back on the drag and become Varla, you know, on stage and for the fans. But of course, I got to know her behind the scenes a little bit too. And of course, you know, she was, wasn't always Varla.
She was a loving grandmother. Did you ever ride in the car with her? Did you let her drive?
You know what? That is such a good question. She drove a fucking crazy ass minivan and I'll never forget like getting into her minivan the first time and just like looking over and being so, being so kind of blown away. But like, I am like in the passenger seat, like with Kara Satana driving a minivan. Just wanted her to like cackle and run someone over.
Did she have like black driving gloves on?
No, but she did wear those for the shows and stuff. She definitely would dress the part and she would give the fans everything they were looking for. Like if you came up and you were a big fan, or let's say you were like a macho guy, you know, who was coming up, she'd get up and put these guys in headlocks and stuff, you know.
That's amazing. Now you just mentioned Mink Stole, and you're touring. You're doing a little tour with Mink of Idol Worship.
You're
coming here to Chicago on Wednesday, April 18th, and I assume it's probably almost already sold out.
If it's not, I mean, my business partner, Bobby, gets back from Ireland, or actually got back yesterday, so I'm going to find out from him today. But if it's not sold out, it's very, very close. I think we only had a handful of the VIP tickets left a few days ago. So if someone wants to go, they should grab a ticket. And Mink and I just did it in Jacksonville. We just did the show in Jacksonville. And what I love about the show is no matter what, every time we do it, I get some sort of new tidbit or new story, you know. Something new comes out. So I'm really looking forward to Chicago. We're excited to come and be there. And if you're a fan of those early John Waters movies, like this is the show for you. And we go from
And you're
Chicago.
Not just like Mink Stole's therapist for an hour. You're actually
I probably still like the annoying fan who's just, you know, just sort of because I know some of the stories now, or I know so many of them, I kind of am able to like guide the conversation through what I believe would be interesting tidbits about the making of these movies and the behind the scenes lives of these people. So I can kind of guide the conversation so that the audience, who are also hopefully fans of the movies, are getting, you know, some interesting and fascinating tidbits. You know, like I always loved finding out that, you know, the house that Connie and Raymond Marble live in was actually the house that John Waters and Mink were roommates in, and that all of the posters and stuff on the wall, that's not art direction, that's just this John's poster collection from the time. You know, so stuff like that I really love bringing out in the conversation so that the audience kind of gets to watch the movies with new insight.
Should we all be making films with our best friends when we're in college, like the way John Waters did?
That's what Snapchat wants, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Maybe. I don't know. I guess it depends on what kind of filmmaker you want to be. I would say that we shouldn't, or that people shouldn't try to be John Waters.
Well, John Waters isn't John Waters anymore.
Right, exactly. It was a time and a place, and but I see these filmmakers sometimes who are inspired by other filmmakers who kind of try to recreate something that's already been done. And I would say it's a stronger idea to just do your own thing and take inspiration, you know, from parts of it, but to try to carve your own. It's not going to work if you just model yourself after someone else.
Sure. Well, and he was so transgressive, and you know, there's so many taboos with that film. And like, and nowadays it's like, do we really have that many taboos left?
I mean, that's the thing. I feel like every few years, a new kind of shock value sort of filmmaker comes along. And I don't know what's going to be next. But I remember, you know, 20 years ago now when Welcome to the Dollhouse came out and happiness and looking at those Todd Solondz movies and being like, wow, this is, this is a new, you know, a new form of shock value. It's a new way to kind of hold a mirror up to this, you know, culture or whatever. And it was, yeah, so shocking. But now, you know, we're 20 years later. So I don't know. I don't know what the new shocking thing is.
Maybe Roseanne is the new shock.
Well, I mean, touche. Yeah, maybe. I think that's
the most antisocial thing is to support an antisocial president.
I mean, people have joked about that for years, right? Like, even John has talked in his lectures about, like, oh, you know, what's going to be punk rock later in life is going to be to come home and, you know, tell the parents who've been raised on the movies of Rocky Horror and John Waters, you know, to come home and tell them, you know, I'm a Republican or I'm a Trump supporter. Mm. And maybe that's where we're at, you know? Like, that is shocking. That is shocking. I think the world is so shocking right now that maybe we don't need those movies the way we have been able to be more entertained by them in the past. Mm-hmm. Like, the world is so awful and shocking that, like, when kids go to, you know, school and have to do drills about what to do or where to hide when a gun person, you know, comes in.
Right.
Maybe we don't need that in our cinema. You know, that's what they say is cultures, you know, where there's a lot of war or a lot of violence or a lot of upsetting stuff, they don't respond as well to horror films or violent
comfort.
Movies.
They want
exactly. And I feel like that's where we're at in the United States. Mm-hmm. Like, as an artist, I don't feel the need to push boundaries in my shows the same way I did in the past. And I don't think it's because I've softened. I think it's because I'm reading the audience. They just want escape and they want to feel part of a group. And so Roseanne right now, Roseanne Barr is fucking shocking. Mm. It is truly shocking. Mm.
They just want to be loved, Captain. Oh, love them all.
Well, Peaches, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
And yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course, anytime. And we look forward to seeing you, less than 2 weeks, right?
It's less than 2 weeks. I'll be in Chicago.
Hopefully we'll have some decent weather for you this time. I feel like every time you come, it's either freezing or hot.
I know. Your weather blows.
It sure does.
I also hope I get a chance to get into that kitchen.
Ooh.
I just want the listeners to know I've been begging to be on Cooking with Drag Queens, and these two ham bones have told me I'm not famous enough.
That's not true. That we have so tons of people that are not true. Famous.
We've been begging you.
We've been begging you to come on.
Well, I guess they'll just have to wait and see if it happens.
And
then
push came to shove. I said, Peaches, what's it going to take to bring you to town? And you said, well, if I do idol worship in Chicago, maybe I'll stop by and I'll cook something with you. I said, all right, well, let's make it happen. So,
and that is exactly how it all came together. And that brings up a good point of, like, after Chicago, we go and do it in Pittsburgh. So if any of you are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mark's kind of hometown,
this is my third hometown.
See us.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and if you have a cooking show, maybe she'll stop by and cook with you too.
Yeah.
You actually have some good recipes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you actually cook in your home?
No.
You eat out a lot.
I do. Yeah.
What about your Nihat? Does he cook for you?
He cooks way more than I cook.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I made you a wonderful.
Is it weird Turkish stuff or is it like delicious Turkish stuff?
Weird Turkish stuff. You mean like organs and stuff?
Yeah.
No, he does more like the good Turkish stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like a eyeball soup and, you know,
peacock's
tongue stew.
Tongue kebabs, you know, things like that.
Goat dick.
Yeah, goat dick. That's pretty much that's my diet, you know.
Well, thank you, Peaches.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Right,
bye-bye. Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco.
Check her out with Mink Stole here in Chicago, April the 18th at Hamburger Mary's, where they're going to be performing their two-woman show, Idol Worship, where you get to know all the dirty little secrets behind all the films of John Waters.
So they're going to show some video, they'll sing some songs, and then Peaches will talk to Mink about her life and her work.
And Mark and I might dress up for the occasion, mm-hmm. and we suggest you should too.
Because I'll tell you what, if you're in costume, you're going to get first in line.
That's right, baby. And, you know, Mink Stole likes it when you're a woman on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
For sure.
Because wild women do not get the blues.
No, they don't.
They get the selfies.
And they inspire a lot of great drag.
I know. What is it? What is it about? I'm just trying to understand, like, you know, what is it our attraction to these bohemian free spirits in their feminine shape?
I think they give you permission to be yourself or to be something that's like your exaggerated self, maybe.
And, you know, it's kind of like the Greek god. The Greeks had their in their religion. They had female spirits, the muses, mm-hmm. to inspire people to be creative.
Ah,
right.
Yeah. And, so these are our modern muses.
And when we see these, you know, free spirits rollerblading down Venice Beach.
I'm alive.
You know, that's ultimately mm-hmm. the function that they play for us in a society. They're to inspire us to express ourselves creatively and fearlessly be ourselves. I want to thank all the fantastic people that listen to the show. I want to also deeply thank you personally from the bottom of my heart of your financial support on doing this podcast, and also for my GoFundMe at GoFundMe.com/Fausto, where you guys have been helping pay for my medical bills.
And so many people have come forward and have been so very generous, and we're very thankful. And, you know, a healthy Fausto
is a happy Fausto
and a happy Mark and a great feast of fun.
It is very difficult place to be to ask for help. And it's a very vulnerable place to be, especially because it's like, you know, your health and your existence is being challenged. Mm-hmm. And I'm not scared of the medical challenges. I'm scared of the medical bills. Mm-hmm. And you guys have given me the courage to overcome that challenge. And I'm forever grateful for that. So thank you guys so much for listening. And if you have been thinking about making a contribution, you can do so at GoFundMe.com/Fausto or become a premium member and access 14 years of our podcasts at feastoffun.com/plus.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've known Peaches now, I think it's 10 years now, and I'm so mm-hmm. grateful to have her as a guest of the podcast, coming back and talking about movies and drag and just so many different things. And I mean, literally, we've talked to her for hours and hours and hours, and you can access all that at feastoffun.com/plus.
Throughout the ages, mm-hmm. people evolve and change mm-hmm. and grow, and sometimes people drift apart. And I'm very grateful that somebody that we value so much mm-hmm. as Peaches Christ is still part of our lives as much as we're part of hers. And it's something very special, and it doesn't happen every day. And those kind of friendships are the thing that I hold closest to my heart. You know, Peaches is not just a treasure to the world, but she's also a treasure to me and to you. Mm-hmm. And we're so happy that we're able to share her wisdom and insight with you guys on the show. She's not, you know, she is no dumb bunny. And she
not by any means.
And not by any means. And she's somebody who really has a lot of generosity and an affection for building community and creating opportunities for people of all walks of life to express themselves creatively. And so in many ways, Peaches Christ is a muse for many of her people in her community.
Undoubtedly.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the show. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.